The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Dr. Placide, Dr. Sewer, we just did our presentation on lumbar spinal stenosis, degenerative stenosis of the lumbar spine, and a multidisciplinary approach to that. So, Dr. Sewer, if you'd be so kind as to introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Michael Sewer. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin, board certified in physical medicine, rehabilitation, and pain medicine, working in the spine clinic.
Thank you. And Dr. Placide?
Rick Placide. I'm a professor of orthopedic surgery at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia, and I specialize in spine surgery.
And I'm Evan Johnson. I'm a physical therapist at Columbia University Medical Center and New York Presbyterian Ox Spine, and assistant professor. So, to kick it off, I think one of the questions that comes up often is, how do we know when to apply the treatment that we apply? So I'd like to start with you, Dr. Sewer. When you see a patient and they come in with lumbar spinal stenosis, with neurogenic claudication, so some referred pain down the leg, worse with walking, better with sitting, what are the things that you consider when you consider the next right step for the patient?
So I think the first thing I consider is really the dysfunction of the patient. Are they able to do the things they want to do on a day-to-day basis? And that's an individualized question. There are some patients who simply want to be able to go to the grocery store. There's other patients that want to do more high-level activities. And you have to judge your treatment and how you progress through those treatments based on the function of the patient and what their eventual outcome goals are. Oftentimes, patients have started some initial treatments before they come in, and they may have a preconceived notion as far as their own history or history of friends as far as what type of further treatments they'd like to pursue. So that's my initial screen as far as what can you and can't you do on a day-to-day basis, what are your goals, and what are your thoughts coming in as far as the treatments that you have available for you.
So before going to Dr. Placide, to pick up on that, it's interesting, I often find that patients who come to see me for physical therapy have had physical therapy previously. And it's a broad net that we throw out for physical therapy. Are there questions you ask regarding the previous conservative care before referring a patient out, either to surgery, considering an intervention, or other procedure?
Yeah, I think the biggest question is, when did you have physical therapy and was it for the same condition? Oftentimes I'll say, has physical therapy worked in the past? And they'll say, no. I say, well, did you do it for your back? No, I did it for my shoulder. Okay, well, we need to have a little reset at that point and discuss, have you actually done those more conservative treatments for your back? And is your thought that they haven't worked based on physical therapy from previous injuries or other areas? Or have you actually had spine physical therapy? And if it is spine PT, what were they treating? The simplest way for me to break that down, because patients often don't know exactly the name of the treatment they were doing, but I'll ask them, were they working on flexion things? We were trying to bend forward. Were they working on extension? We were trying to work backward. And I'll ask some general questions as far as the physical therapy exercises they were prescribed and how that affected their pain, if it did affect it at all.
Interesting. So Dr. Placide, in many instances, the patient will show up at the surgeon's office before they've had conservative care or they've had minimal conservative care. You have the advantage of both having been in physical therapy and then going on to become an orthopedic surgeon. What are your considerations when a patient comes in the door? How do you decide how to refer that or triage that patient on, or whether they should come to you for surgery?
Right, so it depends, as has been mentioned, the initial patient evaluation, their assessment, the severity of the symptoms, the physical exam, also having a discussion if they've had minimal care before or if they've had no treatment. So coming up with a diagnosis, if the patient is already being referred with known lumbar stenosis, meaning they have imaging and they've had someone else evaluate them, that's one story. That's a bit easier. If the patient comes in with the signs and symptoms of lumbar spinal stenosis but has not had any workup, no imaging or previous evaluations, that's different, because then we have to look at the entire differential diagnosis. Is this degenerative lumbar stenosis, or is there something else causing the symptoms? So if we assume that it's basic lumbar spinal stenosis, the treatment is almost always a first referral to physical therapy or manual therapy, chiropractic care, barring any severe neurologic deficits.
Following up on that, since this is a condition that favors or tends to affect the elderly the most, it's not unusual to see both musculoskeletal comorbidities, and also other medical and systemic comorbidities. What's a That's typical right. screen? What information do you want in hand before you make the referral on?
So the medical comorbidities, again, if we're thinking about a referral for physical therapy or chiropractic care, that probably won't affect that decision very much. I do like to question the patient and make sure that they're being tended to, that they actually follow up with their primary care doctor and their diabetes or heart disease is being checked on. But the next step is really the physical exam. If somebody has obvious neurologic deficits, it's clearly onto advanced imaging to get a diagnosis.
And Dr. Sewer, you had mentioned that you have some concerns with patients if they're osteoporotic, the exposure to cortisone, should you do an epidural steroid injection. What came to mind to me was also the diabetic patient who may have some mixture of diabetic neuropathy and also lumbar spinal stenosis and is going to be particularly sensitive to the cortisone. How do you work through that with your patients?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting topic, and it's one that we're actually debating within the interventional world at this point. There are some research studies that you don't necessarily need a corticosteroid when you're injecting for stenosis, and that a local anesthetic could do a similar treatment as far as the outcomes. So there are some individuals where we may elect to forego the steroid part of the epidural injection. With that, if they are getting a steroid injection and they have other medical comorbidities, I think performing the consent and indicating that there are downstream effects from these injections that they do need to be aware of. For diabetes in particular, we will tell them that their blood sugars may be elevated for several weeks afterward. So if they are checking their blood sugars, if they're using sliding scale insulin, they may need to adjust the amount of insulin they're taking. If we're looking globally at a hemoglobin A1C, that may not matter as much, but it is a significant amount of time where they will have a slightly elevated blood sugar from that. Similar with osteoporosis, if someone has treated osteoporosis, that's different than someone who has osteoporosis and four or five compression fractures that we really need to be very careful around, because the last thing we want to be doing is causing more harm. And if we do an intervention that does cause more harm, I think we really need to be evaluating what we're doing and determining if that steroid is really necessary or if it's going to be doing potentially more harm than good.
Interesting. There's the issue as a physical therapist, we do a lot of patient education, as both of you do, but we spend a lot of time with the patient. There's increasing interest, and rightfully so, in social determinants of healthcare, in lifestyle issues. And so when you think about some of the patient's presentation, the possibility that obesity is contributing to their condition, the possibility that they have other issues going on in their life, the possibility that they may not actually have access to the kind of health care that, that a lot of society does. Any special considerations in that regard when you refer a patient on or make a decision regarding their care?
So we're fortunate enough at our university to have a lot of different options at our disposal, nutritional counseling, weight, the endocrinology, all of this, all of the structure is there if the patient needs a particular care for comorbidity or other. So we're lucky we have that, and that is fairly common that we make those referrals as well. Mm. At the same time that we may be referring to physical therapy or to interventional. Yeah.
Dr. Sewer, I'd ask the same question of you, and also the availability of potentially psychological support. Patient is depressed or has high levels of anxiety. Anything in that regard that you have systemically in your system?
Yeah, our system is also very, very fortunate in that in our clinics, we are multidisciplinary. So our pain clinic actually has pain psychology and pain psychiatry on staff. They teach lectures on a regular basis to patients, and they can get referrals to that on managing pain and depression or anxiety, and how do you develop these life skills for managing when you have chronic pain. So that's something that we have that's readily available, and we'd like our patients to take advantage of those resources and make sure that our patients are aware that those resources are available, whether we have a brochure in the room and mention the brochure, or we're doing our due diligence of actually mentioning it during the visit.
It's an interesting, the point of patient education, the point of the post-treatment. Mm-hmm. So we're often in a position as physical therapists that we see the patient after their injection, maybe depending on the physician, maybe 72 hours after or a week after, or postoperatively. And the encouragement that comes from the physician, the emphasis placed on prior to the procedure, prior to the surgery, has a huge impact on our ability to then motivate the patient to a different lifestyle. So I guess I would ask, what's the conversations you have with a patient prior, the patient who does need, let's say, a decompression and possibly a decompression infusion? Mm-hmm. What's the conversation you have with them prior to the surgery to prepare them for the postoperative?
Right. That's a very good question. So the conversation is always based on the surgical procedure and the risks and benefits of the surgery. That's fairly standard. But then we take it next step. I usually discuss the typical in-hospital course that they can expect, as well as the post-operative course, all the way down to 3 to 6 months down the road. And that typically includes when the patient would be considered, or when we would have the discussion about referring for post-operative physical therapy. That's always part of the discussion preoperatively.
And in your case, Dr. Sewell?
Yeah, I often tell people I'm not going in and fixing the issue. An epidural injection is not going to totally alleviate everything associated with whatever is causing compression. Oftentimes what I'll tell patients is that the injection is utilized to help reduce pain, improve function so that you can return to physical therapy and take advantage of those times where you're feeling really good to get your back more stability, better support, potentially more flexibility. So when that injection inevitably wears off, hopefully you're in a better spot from a strength and flexibility standpoint.
I think it would be nice to bring up one more topic. So we spoke about the comorbidities in terms of their medical system. We've often spoken in the past about regional interdependence. So many of these patients who come in with lumbar spinal stenosis, degenerative stenosis specifically, have either hip osteoarthritis, knee osteoarthritis, a history of other injuries that then impact their ability to change a lifestyle, to participate actively in rehabilitation. When you look at your patient and you consider them in that light, how do you prioritize their needs relative to a potential surgery?
Right, so it depends on, again, their presentation, the symptoms, the severity, if it's completely altering their activities of daily living. You become more aggressive quickly, but that's typically not the case. Usually it's still, for me, as the first referral is to physical therapy. And any of the other disciplines that may be impactful. I've found some patients, not everyone has the access, but even aquatic therapy or aquatic water aerobics, they unweight those limbs that are so crippled, and I think that helps in conjunction with the other therapies we've discussed.
Yeah, I find that very useful often as well. Yeah. It's hard to get the resources in place. Sometimes they can go take a class at the local Y or something like that. Yeah. And Dr. Sewer, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, the only time I want to say skip steps, so if I were to skip physical therapy, chiropractic care, would be the patients that come in for an acute pain and have the inability to even perform daily activities. And I walk into the room, they're laying on the table because they can't even move their back at all. In those instances, I would say that I may jump straight to an injection or to a medication and then circle back around to the more conservative treatments. And aquatic therapy is one that I love, even in that scenario when you unweight the spine for someone who has a really difficult time moving. But again, it's an access issue. And cold water is very different than warm water when someone has back pain and their muscles are locked down trying to protect their low back. Warm water seems to work much better.
In deference to some of the newer research, I would just like to bring up this idea of treating a neighboring region that maybe is affecting the function of the spine or causing a neurogenic claudication, right? Or adding to a neurogenic claudication because of stiffness in the hips, right? Or a hip flexor contracture. We touched on that today.
Right.
So I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's not necessarily commonly practiced, and yet there's mounting research to support it. Do you find in the climate that both of you practice in, do you find that the referrals that you make to physical therapy, to chiropractors, to other conservative care clinicians, that they're able to do that and they have the time, they have the thought process, that mm-hmm. it's something that you see?
Yeah, once again, we're very fortunate to have some excellent therapists in our area, in Richmond, Virginia, and it wouldn't necessarily be a lumbar spinal stenosis referral. If the patient has hip arthritis, that's going to be addressed as well as, again, an adjacent body segment, as you talk about. If the hip is very severe, sometimes it's not unreasonable to have one of my joint replacement colleagues see the patient as well. And then referral to interventional for differential injections.
Indeed. And we really didn't touch on that. I think maybe that's a nice place to sum this up. In terms of differential diagnosis and your role as somebody who can affect differential diagnosis and then help determine the course of treatment going forward, how do you see that role and how do you perform it? That's a large question.
I think for me, the primary way to answer that question is I need to find the underlying primary diagnosis. We see this very commonly with lumbar stenosis, where someone has the forward lean at the waist. All of a sudden, their back muscles are working tighter. Their SI joints may have some dysfunction. The gluteus medius muscles are tight, and that leads to greater trochanteric bursitis, leads to hip tightness. And if we go in and only address, say, the SI joint dysfunction, and we even do a great SI joint injection, the patient may only be better for a week or two because we didn't treat the underlying issue. And I think that's one thing that's very difficult when talking to patients is that all of this is connected. An issue in one spot in your spine is going to lead to several downstream effects. And I view my goal in that realm is finding the underlying source of the pain so we can address that. And then oftentimes using physical therapy and other modalities to address the secondary issues. There are times, however, when we do an epidural injection, for instance, for stenosis, and they come back in 6 weeks later and they're still having SI joint dysfunction. They have multiple positive SI joint maneuvers, but they're standing more upright. And at that point, I may look at it and say, well, maybe the stenosis is better, but we still have these secondary things that are not getting better despite conservative management. Is there something else we can do from an interventional standpoint to help address these secondary causes of pain?
So ultimately, whatever box we create, we'll have patients who don't fit in the box and who have unique needs, yes? Yeah. So I think all of us can say that we really strongly advocate for a multidisciplinary approach. Mm-hmm. I've gained so much from the ability to work with surgeons, with rehab medicine physicians, with chiropractors.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's just, it offers the patients many things.
Agreed.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
I look forward to future platforms.
Thank you.